This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 170 was recorded on June 6th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you, a doubleheader, in fact. Santiago Capital founder Brent Johnson headlines as this week's feature interview guest. We'll briefly review Brent's dollar milkshake thesis and then discuss how that translates to an outlook for stocks, bond yields, gold, and much more. We aired the first episode of an experimental new podcast format called Inside the Investment Committee this week, and we particularly welcome your feedback on the new format as we continue to expand the Macro Voices brand and experiment with new innovative formats. So please let us know what you think about this one. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when we'll be joined by Adam Collins from Movement Capital, who operates the freecotdata.com website, which reorganizes the government's commitment of traders' reports into a context that's much more useful to traders and investors. We're going to take a closer look at those commitment of traders' reports and how they work in our post-game segment coming up right after the feature interview with Brent Johnson.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Let's get right into the S&P 500 here, Eric. I mean, we had a pretty solid sell-off, and then it ended with what has been now a pretty solid rebound in the last 3 days. What's your thinking here on the S&P?
Well, I'm not the slightest bit surprised that the market is going up when I think that the economic reality suggests that it should go further down. But if you look at what's been driving the market, it really should come as no surprise. A lot of this has been driven, Patrick, by the Chinese trade deal and Fed policy and so forth. And now we've got this comment from Fed Governor Bullard saying that the Fed is going to have to cut interest rates or is likely going to have to cut interest rates, something that all of the smartest guys in the room already knew and had been saying on Macro Voices. But now we've got a Fed governor saying it. So that was one signal. There are also rumors starting to circulate that maybe there's some kind of China trade deal at the end of June that's going to come out. You never know what to read into those rumors. But one way or another, it's helping the market to recover. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the market ought to be looking at Bullard's comment as an admission. The Fed was unable to stay the course on its quantitative tightening and hiking cycle because the economy can't tolerate it. The economy is much worse than they thought. This is all in the big grand scheme of things, reasons for concern, not reasons for excitement. But the market can't seem to see past, okay, more Fed accommodation is coming, more easy money, let's jump for joy, and stocks are rallying. As far as the real problems that I think are going to cause really serious problems for this market down the road, it's not what's driving the tape action right now.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, because for the entire month of May, we kept toying with a bull breakout that it was going to go. And no sooner do we have Brent Johnson coming onto the show, we have a dollar that's at least retreating off of the highs. It doesn't look like a new downtrend or anything, but what's your take here on the dollar?
Well, I think it's entirely explained by Bullard's comment that the Fed is likely going to ease. Patrick, the way most market participants think about the dollar index is that it's all about interest rate differentials. So clearly, Bullard's comment that the Fed is likely going to have to cut interest rates is dollar negative according to that old school rationale that that's what it's all about. My contention is that's not what it's all about. I think that Jeff Snyder's thesis about a dollar squeeze and a global dollar liquidity shortage are really what's driving this. Now, we've seen this before when there was a dovish pivot by the Fed. All of a sudden, there's a pullback in the dollar, and all of the dollar bears are screaming at the top of their lungs, this is it, the dollar's crashing, the end is nigh. And after a few days, we see that there's just a knee-jerk reaction lower, and then the dollar resumes its climb. So I think this is a buying opportunity, and I think there's a bigger buying opportunity coming, and that's when the Fed is not talking about cutting, but actually cuts rates, especially if it catches the market by surprise, and there's a 50 basis point cut that nobody saw coming, you could see a huge spike down in the dollar. And I think, again, that that will be a buying opportunity. So, yeah, the tape's looking a little bit weak here. But even in the face of this comment from Bullard talking about a change in direction in FOMC policy, we're still seeing what I think is a modest pullback. And I think that it's a buying opportunity before the bullish trend continues.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, because I would love to get your opinion on what happened here. I mean, we were just toying with $60 a week ago, and suddenly we found ourselves in a pretty heavy sell-off, not so much today, but what's going on here in crude?
Well, of course, we've got our new Energy Week program, so we went into more detail on this on yesterday's Energy Week, so I'll just give a quick summary. But basically, yeah, we've seen a major change in sentiment. It's been driven largely by inventory, and let's cover those EIA inventory data. It's just massive, massive builds on inventory. Crude oil building 6.7 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma building a massive 1.8 million barrels. Now, oftentimes, when we have those big crude builds, they're offset by drawdowns in finished product. And you kind of have to say, okay, well, net-net, it's not that big. This week, it's just builds across the board, Patrick. Gasoline building 3.2 million barrels. Distillates building an utterly huge 4.6 million barrels on the week. Needless to say, the tape action was not just down, but panic down in both RBOB gasoline and the crudes. The thing is, though, we hit a pretty good technical support level yesterday. We actually went through it, recovered to close about on it. And then today on Thursday, most of the day, it was kind of sideways, not much going on. And then just into the pit close at 2:30, there was a sudden last minute rally, and we recaptured the 5-day moving average at 52.98 on WTI crude oil. RBOB gasoline, as I'm looking at the tape just a few minutes before 4 o'clock here, we're not quite back to RBOB's 5-day moving average, but we're just a few ticks away from it. And it looks to me like we're at least going to test the 5 days. Maybe this is the beginning of a bigger bounce. Now, I do think that the downtrend is likely set to continue unless there's some material change in the news flow. But, you know, we've come a long, long way down. We're overdue for a bounce. Right now, we've got a technical level that's holding so far, and a rally into the pit close today suggests to me maybe the bounce has begun. But at this point, I think the question is, how high do we bounce before the selling continues? I don't think this is over yet, but I do think there's a very good chance that a bounce has begun. Now, beyond the inventory numbers, U.S. production ticked up to a new all-time high of 12.4 million barrels. Keep in mind that the rig count had been declining. A whole bunch of people were predicting that there would be a reversal in the trend of U.S. production. We went up to 12.3, then we came down to 12.1, and a bunch of people were saying, okay, this is it. The trend reversal is on us. Well, clearly, the trend reversal is not on us. We're back up to yet another all-time high. Imports, 7.9 million barrels per day this week. Exports, 3.3 million barrels. So that's 23 million barrels on the week of U.S. crude oil exported out of the country. And even after you take those 23 million barrels out, you've still got 6.7 million barrels of additional stock build after the 23 million barrels were exported. So I think that the downtrend, which is clearly in play, is probably not over, but we're already overdue for a bounce, and it looks like maybe one is starting.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because what a change week over week. We cleared that 1300 level, and it just took off like a rocket. What's your thinking here on gold?
Patrick, my first comment is a one-word comment, wow, and I should admit that I was not expecting this. Now, this clearly qualifies as a breakout by any reasonable measure. So we've broken the downsloping trend line very aggressively, and now we're retesting that just super, super critical resistance level. 1350, 1360, depending on how you measure it. I think 1360 is a safer number to use as critical resistance. It's been close to 5 years now that we haven't been able to get above that number. And if we are able to, you can make an argument that there's a cup and handle formation in the chart that looks very bullish. So it could be a setup for much higher numbers if I just look at the technicals. Now, this, needless to say, is an outcome that I was not expecting. I do still think that the most likely outcome here is a failed test at this level and a reversal lower. But frankly, I've got to handicap myself. I wasn't expecting it to get this high. So, you know, my ability to read the market, at least with respect to gold in the last few weeks, is not exactly perfectly tuned. So we'll see what happens. Now, if we do get a breakout, I think it's very tricky to trade because this resistance at 1350, 1360 has been here for 5 years. That means that in order to really have a decisive breakout, it's not just a daily close once over those numbers. It needs to stay there for a while. And of course, if you wait for it to stay there for a while, you might miss the move. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Patrick, I think there's a good chance this is going to play out the way the 10-year Treasury yield did, where we got to 3.10 and everybody said that's at the critical level. We started to break out above it. Everybody piled in. It got all the way to 3.25, turned out to be a false breakout, a reversal, and it was a very bearish sign. Now, needless to say, I've been bearish and I've been wrong in recent history, so I might be wrong again. But certainly, I'm not buying here just a few points below a critical resistance level. I'm waiting for the breakout, and I may jump on the boat if I'm convinced the breakout has legs.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yield because we dropped almost 50 basis points in a month. It's an incredible move. I mean, we're a stone's throw away from 2%. What happens next year?
Well, it's really just amazing. You know, just this afternoon as we're getting ready to tape the show, I'm putting my notes together and it's like, yeah, I've got to get the thing. I'm looking at the thing, 2.09. No, I want the 10-year yield. Where's the 10-year yield? Oh, that is the 10-year yield. And it's back up now. I'm looking at 2.13 just before the close. But I did see 2.09 go across my screen earlier. So needless to say, wow. So the conundrum here, Patrick, is I do think that the fundamentals are in place for even lower yields. I think this move does have room to continue. But boy, it's moved so far so fast. Certainly count yourself lucky if you bought 2.60 when I told you to on this program a few weeks ago. But now that we're here at 2.13, below 2.10 earlier in the day, we've gone so far so fast, it feels to me like time for a pullback. So I would think about taking some profits here if you've been long since 2.60 and waiting for that pullback. But frankly, I thought that last week, and we still surged even lower in yields. So who knows how far this can go, but it's gone awfully far without a pullback. I think we're overdue for one.
All right. Well, before we move on to the feature interview, please give us a quick update on your efforts to secure sponsorship for the new programming so that we can keep Macro Voices free for our listeners.
Well, first of all, I really want to thank everyone who has donated to Macro Voices using the donate button on our macrovoices.com website in the last few weeks. Those donations have directly enabled moving forward with Inside the Investment Committee, even before we secured our first corporate sponsor. So we really need help from listeners who work in companies that would make a good sponsor for Macro Voices. We have one sponsorship discussion that has moved on from our listener to a serious negotiation with the appropriate department in his company. And there are about three other listeners advocating for us inside their organizations as well. But we still need more help. It's going to take more than one sponsor to keep Macro Voices free. So to make this easier, I've produced a pitch video describing the history of the Macro Voices brand, all of the audience demographics and download statistics, and a description of our expansion plans, a description of the sponsorship packages on offer, the whole nine yards. The idea is that our listeners who are interested in helping us can watch the video to arm themselves with all of the facts and figures needed to make the case on our behalf to your marketing department. And then once you've got their attention, you can send them the video, which is basically the sales pitch for why they should sponsor Macro Voices. In hindsight, at 24 minutes long, the video is probably longer than it should be, but I think it makes a really strong case for the values that sponsors will receive. You'll find the video at macrovoices.com/sponsor info. That's all one word, no punctuation, macrovoices.com/sponsor info. So if you want to help us keep Macro Voices free for listeners, please have a look at the video and consider who in your organization you might send it to.
Well, Eric, thanks for the update. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Santiago Capital founder Brent Johnson. Eric, why did we invite Brent onto the show this week?
Well, you know, this was an embarrassing story for me, Patrick. When we were taping Brent's interview, I asked our production team, guys, be sure to get links to all of Brent's previous feature interviews into the article so our listeners can find them. And they couldn't find them. They're telling me, oh, you got to send me the link. I said, come on, guys, put it in the website. It's in the search box. Look. And then Brent piped up and said, Eric, this is my first time. I've never done this before. And I said, oh, it's funny because, you know, Brent is one of our Macro Voices All-Stars. I chose the All-Stars as the very best of our feature interview guests that our listeners want to hear more from. And Brent is in All-Stars without ever having done his first Macro Voices full-length interview. And I think the reason is we've had him at Macro Voices Live as a speaker where he was fantastic. We've had him in a couple of post-game segments reacting to one of Luke Groman's interviews. And I didn't even realize that we had yet to give him his own feature interview. I kind of feel badly about that. I have tremendous respect for Brent, and I think the combination of Brent and Luke Groman's views is just so important because these are two people who on the surface appear to be in diametric disagreement with one another. But I think if you really look beyond the surface, they really do agree in the long term. They have very different views on how things will play out before we eventually get to that Luke Groman endgame. I don't know which one of them is right, but it's very interesting to me to weigh these opinions. And I think particularly the way that Brent thinks about what some of the consequences and ramifications of a big dollar rally could be in terms of how it would affect other markets are particularly insightful. So I'm really excited about this particular interview and looking forward to it with Brent.
All right, well, Eric's interview with Brent Johnson is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is Santiago Capital founder Brent Johnson. Brent is extremely well known for his dollar milkshake theory, which in my opinion, along with Jeff Snyder's dollar squeeze theory, are really one of the most insightful explanations of what's been going on with the dollar index and the reason that we've seen so much strength in the dollar, even when interest rate differentials would seem to suggest otherwise. I want to refer our listeners, before we get into the interview with Brent, to a couple of previous episodes. We've had Brent on, not in his own feature interview, this will be Brent's first feature interview today, but we had him almost as a rebuttal to Luke Groman's last feature interview. The link to that episode, including Luke Groman's very dollar bearish story along with Brent's dollar bullish rebuttal, you can find that in your research roundup or on our homepage at macrovoices.com next to Brent's picture. Also, Brent recently did an All-Stars appearance for Macro Voices, where we talked a little bit about the dollar. Brent, I think that since we have not had you on the program as a feature interview guest before, I'd like to just do a quick recap of your dollar milkshake theory. What is this all about, and why is it that you think about the U.S. dollar index a little differently than most analysts who tend to think that really the value of the dollar has everything to do with interest rate differentials, and a lot of analysts really don't see some of the other aspects that you believe is driving the dollar?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks again for having me, Eric. Always happy to talk to you and your listeners. I'll go through the milkshake theory pretty quickly. There's a lot of info out there on it for those who want to have a deeper dive. But essentially, the dollar milkshake theory is kind of a play on a movie about the where this guy was drinking up the oil of his next door neighbor by using a straw. And so what I mean by that is that over the last, you know, let's call it 10 years, the central banks took out their monetary syringes and they pushed down on their plungers, which is the interest rates, and they flooded the market, the global market, with liquidity. They printed yen, they printed yuan, they printed dollars, they printed euros, they printed British pounds, et cetera, et cetera. So there was this big pool of capital out there. And that went on from, let's call it, you know, 2010 to 2015 for lack of a better time period. And then at the end of 2015, the U.S. got rid of its syringe and they stuck a straw down into this milkshake that I call it. You know, we've got this currency milkshake out there, and the U.S. stuck their straw down in there by raising interest rates. So now rather than pushing down on their syringes, they're lifting up on their syringes and they're sucking that capital up into the U.S. economy. As that happened, you know, the dollar, I think, started to get stronger. It hasn't broken out yet. And, you know, in some cases, I would argue that the milkshake theory is only just getting started. Some people think it's at its end. I really don't even think it's really started yet. But that higher differential in U.S. interest rates versus the rest of the world, and the fact that our domestic economy, at least on a relative basis, has been stronger than other domestic economies, has pulled capital into the U.S. And as we move forward, I think that that continues. Now, that doesn't mean that things are good here. It doesn't mean that the U.S. economy is accelerating. It doesn't mean it's hitting on all cylinders, for lack of a better, you know, analogy. It just means it's better than everywhere else. And for those who argue that it's not better than everywhere else, I ask, why was the U.S. able to raise interest rates 9 times when, you know, Japan has made modern monetary theory their national pastime and Draghi's never raised once in 10 years? So the fact that we were able to do 9 of them and nobody else can even do 1, to me, kind of validates what I'm saying. Now, again, it doesn't mean that the global economy is strong. It just means that on a relative basis, we are stronger than everybody else. And I think that that continues. And I think as that continues, it pulls capital into the U.S. and it makes the U.S. markets on a relative basis better than everywhere else.
Now, Brent, when I've talked to you about this theory before, and I agree with you, by the way, I think the dollar is definitely getting ready to break out, and I expect it to move much higher. There are a lot of people who disagree strongly with us on that, and they've made their arguments, and that's great. But boy, if you're us and you think the dollar is moving higher, and one of the views that you and I have both had is that all the people that want to get excited about gold, and I think gold is going to be the asset to be long in the long run, but I haven't felt like it's time yet. I think the dollar goes higher and gold goes lower before this is all over. Well, boy, look at the last couple of weeks in gold, Brent. It looks like, to a lot of people, the market is starting to prove us wrong with a breakout that I didn't expect in gold. I thought we might get a little breakout above that downsloping trend line that's been in play for several months, only because so many people think the Fed is maybe getting ready to pivot back to a more accommodative cutting cycle as opposed to a hiking cycle. But I didn't expect it to go this high. Now, as we are speaking on Wednesday morning, we are flirting with 1350, which has been, for 4 or 5 years now, that has been the level that has capped gold. So a lot of people think it's about to break out above 1350, and that would seem to prove us wrong. What do you think about the message we're getting from gold here?
Yeah, it's been quite a couple of weeks for gold. And, you know, kind of to what you said, I was expecting a little bit of a bounce. I didn't expect it would be this high. But I'll tell you, I have not changed my opinion. And before I answer this question specifically, I just want to say that, listen, I'm a huge believer in gold. There may be a handful of people out there who've put out more work than I have of why everybody should own gold in their portfolio. And I still believe that. I just don't happen to think it's going to pay off right now, even despite this short-term bounce. You know, I actually bought some puts on the miners earlier this morning, kind of as a short-term trade, because I think this is a little bit overdone in the short term. And so I do think that gold is going to pull back. Now, I might be wrong. And here's the thing is, I don't mind being wrong. You know what? I've been wrong many times in my life. I'll be wrong many more times going forward. That's the nature of this business. Nobody's going to be in this business for 20 years and not get it wrong on several occasions. You know, kind of one of the key things is when you get it wrong, not to lose too much money, right? And so, you know, I own gold. I don't expect it to pay off now. I thought this morning provided an opportunity to make a little short-term trade, which I entered. But if I lose money on that trade, I'll make money on my long-term gold thesis, and it'll be fine. But I just think that the dollar hasn't even really broken out yet. And I think when the dollar finally breaks out, I think that that's going to at least initially be bad for gold. Now, we've spoken before, and, you know, we've talked about how eventually, I think that there will be enough chaos out there that both gold and the dollar will rise together versus all other currencies. I don't think we're there yet. We might be. And like I said, if I'm wrong and the gold keeps going up, that's fine. You know, I'll say I was wrong and I'll move forward. But in the short term, I think gold's a little bit overdone here. I'd be a little bit careful chasing it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I have not dared to short it here, but I expect what's likely to happen is 1350, 1360 in there somewhere. That's where the very, very strong resistance level has been. And certainly, if we see a decisive breakout above that level, it's time for me to rethink my view and buy some gold too. But so far, I'm not expecting that to happen. And exactly as you say, you know, this is the beauty of these markets. Once you get the process down, it's okay to be wrong as long as you've got a plan for what to do next. Let's move on to bond yields. A lot of people thought, you know, boy, we were going to hit that 3.10 on the 10-year, and it was just going to be all over after that, and we couldn't go anywhere but higher in bond yields. Now we've got moving down to crashing. Crashing is maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but boy, collapsing bond yields. What's going on? Is this about a recession signal, or is there more to this story?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that, listen, the smartest guys I know are all bullish rates, or that they've all been telling me that rates are going to go much lower, perhaps to zero, and to be buying bonds over the last, you know, 6 to 12 months. And you know what? I give them credit. They've been right. It's been a great call. I have exposure to short-term bonds. I have not, you know, I've never loaded up on the long-term or anything, and I haven't made a killing by owning bonds in the last year. But that's okay. That's a trade that I'm okay sitting on the sideline and letting somebody else make money. I completely understand the argument for rates going much lower. I'm just not convinced it's going to happen. And I think it's actually possible that we're seeing somewhat of a low in rates being made now. Now, again, if I'm wrong, that's fine, right? I don't have a problem being wrong on that. It's just if you look up the interest rate probabilities on Bloomberg, the market is saying there's a 99% chance of a rate cut in the next 7 months. And, you know, listen, that is not a contrarian trade. Rates going lower is not a contrarian trade right now. It's very much the consensus right now. In fact, them not cutting would be a very contrarian stance. Now, what ends up happening? You know, I'm not sure. I actually don't think that they're going to raise. Now, if I'm wrong on that, again, fine, I'll adjust and we'll go from there. But I'm not sure that the cutting rates does what they think it will do. The stock market, the U.S. markets are within 2 or 3, maybe 4% of their all-time highs. Inflation is, you know, around 2%, give or take a little bit, right? Employment is extremely low. You know, I'm not sure that they need to cut. Again, I understand the argument for rates going lower, but I just don't think that the Fed needs to cut. And here's the thing. If they do cut, let's just stand back and think about what a rate cut tells you. A rate cut by the Fed, when the market is near its all-time high, inflation is low, and unemployment is low, tells you that behind the scenes, somewhere that you can't see, things are really bad. And to me, that's a very bearish signal that the Fed would be sending to the rest of the world. Now, there's two things from this. If you send out that negative signal, does that really help markets or does it hurt markets? Well, the dollar would probably at least initially go down on that news. So from a headline perspective, maybe it provides a little bit of a down push on the dollar, and that provides a little relief for the people who are having trouble getting dollar funding. But what are the other central banks going to do if we cut? Remember, Japan has been doing QE or, you know, modern monetary theory moves for 20 years now. The ECB has been doing it for 10. Nobody can get off zero except for the US. Are they, after everything they've done, and now the Fed comes in and cuts, do you think those guys are just going to sit there and do nothing? I think as soon as we cut, Japan probably cuts, and maybe Europe goes even more negative. I just don't see this being a huge thing where the U.S. rates are all of a sudden falling, the rest of the world is raising, and the dollar just goes to zero. I actually think that even though if the Fed were to cut and the dollar were to fall on that headline, I think it would be an incredible, incredible buying opportunity. You know, I think I mentioned to you in January, Eric, that I am so convinced that the dollar is going higher over the next couple of years. I'm in the middle of setting up a vehicle to actually play this theory, and we literally are just launching this month. I am looking at across the board at all these different opportunities, and I just cannot believe that they exist.
Brent, I want to jump on that and talk about a little bit more specifically. What are these opportunities that you're looking at? We've talked about a view that we share, which is the dollar's headed higher. Are you just talking about being long the dollar, or is there more to the story?
Well, there's a little bit more to the story, but I'll tell you, Eric, I really think the whole world is the dollar story right now. As goes the dollar, so goes the world. And as we've discussed before, you know, I think ultimately the dollar goes much higher before it goes lower. And the knock-on effects of the dollar going higher, I think, create a lot of disruption in the market. And because the dollar is not expected to go as high as I think it is, the pricing of some trades out there is very favorable for those who do think it's going to go that high. As an example, if you look at the currencies like the yen or the Australian dollar or even the Swiss franc, the euro, because of the wide differential in rates, the option pricing to buy puts versus these other currencies, puts on these other currencies versus the dollar, are very favorable. You can go out and buy a 2 or 3 year put on the euro or the yen and outlay a very small amount of premium to buy a very large exposure should that reverse or should the dollar strengthen versus them. And, you know, the US dollar, for all its flaws, and believe me, I agree, it is very flawed, but for all its flaws, it is still the world reserve currency. It is still used for a huge percent of the world's trade and trade finance. Not only that, but a number of countries have gone out there and borrowed in dollars. The rest of the world, not the US, the rest of the world owes $11 trillion in dollars. And so there's still huge demand for the dollar. And so when the US has rates significantly higher than the rest of the world, and the rest of the world is in many places negative rates, the pricing for that to reverse, because I do believe it will reverse. Now, whether it reverses next month or next year, I don't know. I think it happens sooner than many people think it does. But if you give yourself a 2 year window for this to happen, the pricing on some of these puts versus the dollar are really spectacular.
Brent, I want to move on to the stock market, because if I think about the way most people think about relationships between markets and macroeconomic theory, they would say, okay, this Brent Johnson fellow, he's very, very bullish the dollar. Dollar rallies tend to go with stock market crashes. And furthermore, he's not particularly saying that the dollar strength is about a strong economy. He says it's other factors. So not a really strong U.S. economy. Dollar moving higher. Sounds like this guy must be a super stock bear. But that's actually not the case. Please explain why you have a theory that this dollar rally might actually be the catalyst that causes stocks to move much higher.
Sure. You know, and I'll tell you, out of all the parts of this theory that I get challenged on, this is the one. There are a number of people out there who can understand the dollar getting stronger. They often will come back to me and say, I just don't get the hot stocks going higher part of it. And my thought is that if I'm sitting in somebody else's shoes and I'm not in the US, let's say that I'm in Italy as an example, and I'm managing some kind of a pension fund or an endowment or even just a very large portfolio. Now, say whatever you have to say about the US economy and, you know, criticize it as you will. Fine, I'll accept that. But then compare it to the Italian economy. Now, do you honestly think that the Italian economy is better than the US economy? I have a hard time getting to that one, especially with their banking system, which everybody knows is, for the lack of a better word, insolvent. Now, you also have the potential for Italy with their government to, you know, not play nice with the rest of the EU. And so you're sitting there looking at, as a manager, an asset manager in Italy, and trying to figure out where to place your assets. You can buy European sovereign that's giving you a negative yield, or you can buy a US treasury that's giving you 2% or 2.5%. To me, that's not such a bad idea, right? Because if the euro goes lower and the dollar goes higher, then you get your 2%, 2.5% coupon, and you get the dollar strengthening versus it. All of a sudden, maybe you're at a 4 or 5% return. Well, then you also go out there and you look and you say, okay, what about equities? Do I want to buy an Italian or a Spanish or a UK blue chip company? Or do I want to put my money in a big blue chip US company? I've used the example of Philip Morris before, and I always use that because I think it is a very big company. It's got a great management team. Its product is somewhat recession-proof, and it pays like a 4% dividend. So if I'm sitting in Italy, and I am looking around where to put money, and I can buy U.S. blue chip, and the dollar goes up by 4 or 5% versus the euro, and I get a 4 or 5% dividend on top of it, all of a sudden I'm at 8 or 9% return. That's not so bad, right? And I just think that, and I use the Italian example, but I think it exists for somebody in Australia. I think it exists for someone in Canada. I think it exists for someone in Japan. I think it exists for someone in Spain. I think it's kind of a global thing. Again, it's a relative world. And I think that when things start to break, that the US will be seen as a relative safe haven. And here, this kind of leads into why I had said earlier in this conversation that I'm not even sure that the milkshake theory has really gotten started yet. And that is because the dollar hasn't really broken out yet. And the rest of the world, even though they're not growing gangbusters, they haven't really started breaking down yet. I think when other markets start to break down and they start to realize that their economies are in worse shape than they think that they are, and they start looking for safe havens, that's when I think that the stock, that's when I think the flows are going to start coming back into the U.S. And I think that that can push U.S. equities higher. You know, I saw a chart yesterday, and it showed all the flows that have been going out of equities over the last, I think, 4 or 5 months. And it's a huge number. I don't have it right in front of me. And I was thinking, okay, we've had this huge outflow from equities, and yet they're still within, you know, 3-4% of the all-time highs. What happens when those flows come back, right? Or what happens if the flows just stop leaving? So I think that there's an opportunity for the U.S. equities to go higher, not because things are good, but because in some ways, because things are bad. And that's kind of how it ties into the milkshake theory.
Well, I think that's extremely insightful, Brent, because I have been bearish on U.S. stocks. But if there is one theory that I've heard that really explains to me why I should think about a serious upside risk in stocks, it's exactly what you've described. And I guess the way I would put it is, you know, there's never, ever in all of recorded monetary history been a time when we had dual bubbles in both sovereign bonds and in stocks created by 10 years of accommodative central bank policy. That's never, ever happened before. We're in uncharted territory. And any assumption that we might have about what happens when things start to turn south, normally what happens in most markets is the stock market goes down dramatically and the money flows into the bond market because the bond market was probably already depressed at that point. Well, the bond market's not depressed at this point. It's at all-time highs, all-time low yields, or close to it, within a percent of being the 35-year low. So when you get people panicking, the idea of let's sell all of our stocks, you know, let's say you're in Europe and you've got both European stocks and U.S. stocks in your portfolio. Things are getting bad. It's time to panic. Let's sell all of the interest that we have in stocks, that's ownership in productive companies that actually produce a profit, and let's instead throw the money into negative yielding sovereign debt in a currency block, which a lot of people think is collapsing. It's not necessarily true that people are going to exit stocks and go into bonds, in sovereign bonds in their own countries, the way it's always worked in the past, because these circumstances are so different and nobody knows what's going to happen. So I certainly don't, you know, interpret what you're saying as any kind of certainty that the stock market's going to go way up. But if it does, I think this is probably the explanation is, you know, it's the same thing that so many people have said to me about gold. I've expressed a real skepticism that it's not time yet for gold. And I really think that I'm right about that in U.S. dollars. If you are a European investor and your savings are in euros, the time to get into gold was a long time ago. You know, it's a whole different game. And you've got to understand that that's really big. There is a risk that the European Union is beginning to fall apart. And if it starts to look like it's really falling apart, that's going to create a mass panic exodus. And it's an exodus from what into what? We don't know because the dynamics are completely different. Have you found any corollaries or examples in history where you had a situation where, you know, there was a setup like this where maybe the economy is finally turning south, but you're going into a situation where any flight capital coming out of stocks would have to go into what's already a bond bubble? I mean, out of stocks and into the safety of negative yielding sovereigns?
Well, and that's why I say, listen, there's that famous saying, there's nothing new under the sun, right? This has probably happened before. I don't have a good example off the top of my head. But, you know, it's I just look at now and I say, there's no real easy answer here, right? And I listen, there's this theory that's gone around for the last 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years, where they would talk about TINA, you know, when talking about the stock market, which means there is no alternative. And I always kind of hated it, right? Because there is also, you can always sit on the sideline. You don't have to invest. unless you're a manager of a mutual fund or an endowment or some institution, you don't have the ability to go to the sideline. You know, your mandate says you are invested. Where are you going to place the money? And so you do actually have to put your money somewhere. And I don't believe that people are going to continue to plow their money into a negative yielding bond. Now, could I be wrong? Of course I could be wrong. But as I look around, I have a hard time believing that's the case. And, you know, you mentioned something when you were just talking there that kind of made me think of something else regarding bonds. And, you know, I don't have a big desire to get into the big bond debate. Again, I completely understand the arguments for yields going lower. And very, very smart people believe that that's where it's going. Again, I'm kind of willing to sit on the sideline and let that trade go by. But if I had to take the argument on the other side and I had to challenge the view, this is one thing that I think people may be forgetting or overlooking. Part of the reason that a lot of people think interest rates are going lower is there's very low inflation and the prospects for inflation don't look great. So if I was going to argue for the upside of inflation, this is how I would start it. You know, as part of my whole worldview, I've said before that I think that the rest of the world, as the dollar gets stronger, the rest of the world is going to experience deflationary effects because of all the dollar debt that they owe and the dollar funding that they need. But maybe I should have said it more of a stagflationary as opposed to just pure deflationary, because if you look around the world, especially in emerging markets, food makes up an incredible amount of the cost of daily budgets or daily living expenses. And I think I can make a case where food prices 12 to 18 months from now might not only be higher, but could be significantly higher. And that leads to inflationary effects. And if we start to get those and that starts to percolate up, then maybe the Fed has a harder time continuing to drop rates. You know, if there start to be some inflationary effects, now they've got to start taking that into consideration. Here's how I would argue it. In China, they have the, I guess I'd call a hat trick of problems in their food industry. They've got the Asian swine flu, which I promise you is a bigger issue than even the people who are out there ahead of it are saying it is. There's the army worm, which is now hurting their grain crops. And then last week, they have bird flu outbreak. So now it's attacking their poultry. Now, for the biggest country in the world to potentially go into a food shock trying to feed all their citizens, that's a big problem. And that can lead, you're already starting to see that lead to higher prices in substitutes, such as beef. Now, that's on the meat side of things. But let's talk about the grain side of things. Again, they have the armyworm problem in China. But now in the U.S., we've had some severe storms in the spring. A large percent of the farmable land in the Midwest has not even been planted because they can't get into their fields to plant. And there's still standing water. And the banks of the Mississippi have flooded. We've had the biggest floods along the Mississippi in like 100 years. And so the crop production 6, 12, 18 months from now could be constrained, or the supply of grain could be constrained. Now you've got, all of a sudden you've got rising food prices because demand is still there. We've still got all the people, but we've got less supply. And now you start to get social unrest in these countries where food prices are going up, but their earnings aren't going up and their wages aren't going up. You know, it was 5, 6 years ago where we had the big Arab Spring uprisings across the Middle East and North Africa. It all started because of food prices. So I just think that it's a fascinating world right now. I'm not convinced that inflation is as contained as many people would say it is. And I think that we could start to see some real, not just social, but geopolitical knock-on effects of what's going on. And when that happens, I think the dollar in the U.S. gets capital flows as a result.
I want to talk about the long-term view that you've described associated with the dollar milkshake theory, where you've said that there could be, and I want to be careful, you have not predicted this is a certainty to happen. You've just said there is plenty of possibility for a really, really big move in the dollar index to all-time highs, let's say 125 plus on the dollar index. Here's my problem with that. I'm going to make a little bit of a crazy analogy. If you were a structural engineer and you told me you've done some analysis and you're convinced that the Brooklyn Bridge is going to collapse and the cars driving across it, everybody's going to be killed as a result of this horrible thing, I'd say, wow, that's a big prediction. You know, let's see what your data is. I can believe that that's possible. It's an old bridge. But if you told me that what's going to happen is the bridge is going to collapse, and then for the next 2 months, all day long, cars are going to drive off of it and everybody's going to die, I would say, Brent, you're crazy. They would close the road. Well, I guess what I'm not seeing here is there is so much risk to the global economy. If the dollar really, really starts to take off, let's say above 110 on the dollar index, for the sake of a round number, that would cause so many problems with so many countries and major corporations around the world, foreign companies that have borrowed in U.S. dollars that would suddenly be unable to repay their debts. It would make U.S. exports next to impossible because nobody would be able to afford them. It would cause so much damage, it seems to me like they would close the road. And it wouldn't go any higher. And what I mean by that is some equivalent to the Plaza Accord back in, I think it was 85, when there was an agreement explicitly for governments to work together to suppress the dollar. It seems to me that for any theory that involves the U.S. dollar moving above 110 on the dollar index, there's got to be some analysis of when they at least try to close the road and what happens. So how do you think this would play out? You know, at some point, is there a Plaza Accord? What happens?
Yeah, so very good question. Ultimately, I do think that there will have to be some kind of a Plaza Accord. I think the dollar will have to get revalued lower. I've said before that I actually think when that happens, the Plaza Accord will be welcomed and the rest of the world will beg us to devalue the dollar because they will need it even more than we do. And listen, Trump is a very, very big part of all of this. Now, Trump hates that we have this, you know, strong dollar, right? And he's come out several times and said he wants a weaker dollar. But why does Trump want a weaker dollar? Trump wants a weaker dollar because he wants the stock market to go higher. Well, if the stock market is going higher, I think his concern about the dollar kind of goes to the back burner. And he's more worried about other things and worried about other fires that he's got to put out. And, you know, if we get back into a situation where the dollar is going higher, it creates pressure on other economies. The capital flows from those other economies into the U.S. and the U.S. stock market goes higher. That perhaps keeps Trump happy. Now, maybe not happy is not the right word. I don't think that guy is ever happy, right? But maybe that keeps him from continually jawboning down the dollar. But I do think that as we go along this road, there are going to be attempts to counteract the dollar. This is not going to be a smooth ride from $1.98 to $1.150. It will be extremely scary. It will be extremely volatile. I think there'll be periods where the dollar really spikes and it will pull back hard and it'll spike again and it'll pull back hard. Let's go back to 10 years to 2008. You know, you make the comment that the world just doesn't work with the dollar going to 120, 130, 140. Well, the world didn't really work with the Dow going from 18,000 to 6,000 either, but it happened anyway. You know, if you look through the summer of 2008 and into the fall of 2008 and into the spring of 2009, the markets would go down, the monetary authorities, the central bankers, the governments would come out and they would institute policies, they would ban short selling, they would do some stimulus plan, they would cut rates, and the markets would rally a little bit. And then pretty soon you're back to reality and the markets would crash again and they'd come out, they'd say something else, or they'd institute some other policy and, you know, markets would bounce a little bit and then back to reality and it goes down again. So I do think, to your point, there will be cops that will approach the bridge and tell people don't drive off the bridge. But then I don't know that those cops are going to be able to stop it, to be honest, until they, you know, put up road barriers and completely shut the whole thing down. So I mentioned to somebody before that my theory is not called the glass of milk theory. It's called the milkshake theory. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of shaking going on. And even if I'm right, Eric, even if I get this right, there are going to be moments of pure terror for me along the way and everybody else. This is not a nice, smooth ride to the end game. Listen, this is going to be crazy. I guess that's the best way I can say it. To think it's going to be anything other than crazy, I think is naive. Even if I get part of it right and I'm able to make money on it, it doesn't mean that it's going to come without some real, you know, white knuckling along the way.
Now, I want to ask you how, in the long term, your theories eventually meld together with others, because a lot of our listeners are familiar with Luke Gromans' views. And at first glance, It would seem that you and Luke are just polar opposites who see the world in a completely different way and just can't agree, because Luke has been hugely dollar bearish. And he is, I think, right now tactically still long the dollar, but he's waiting for it to reverse. He thinks it's imminently upon us, and he thinks that the road is much, much lower. So I think most people, casual observers, would assume you guys never see eye to eye. Personally, the way I see it is I am absolutely convinced that Luke is going to be proven right. I just think you're going to be proven right first. And I think Luke has the story exactly right. He's just early. But I want to know what you think about that. Luke's view is basically that the U.S. dollar is going to lose its hegemony over the global financial system, probably lose its reserve currency status, and fade into the sunset, very similar to the way the pound sterling, which used to be the world's global reserve currency. Currency never went away. We've still got the British pound, but it is nowhere close to the importance that it used to have in the global financial system, and it devalued a long way along the way. Do you think that Luke's got that wrong, or do you think he's just way early to expect those things to happen?
So I think a couple of things, and I say this every time I get this question. For that, I like Luke. You know, I actually consider him a friend. You know, if I bumped into him in the airport and we had to sit there and hang out for 2 hours before we each caught our flights, I would enjoy that 2 hours. So I don't have a problem with Luke's criticism of my theories or our debates or however you want to define that, right? I think it's actually maybe a mutually beneficial thing, because there's times I probably make him think about things he hadn't thought of, and vice versa. He definitely makes me think about things that I haven't thought of. I think you're largely correct on how to define our views. I think he is really early, but I do think ultimately a lot of the things that he's is talking about will come to pass. Part of the reason that I perhaps come back against him as strongly as I do is that, you know, I actually manage money for individuals. And so when I'm investing and we're going over, I'm sitting there looking the person in the eye, talking to them about how their results have gone and how this is personally going to affect them. And that's a little different than managing money institutions, where you never actually see the people that it affects. And it's a little different than writing research, where you're not actually placing money in the market. And my experience has been that everybody says they're a long-term investor and they're in it for the long term, until it goes against them. You know, there's that famous saying that everybody has Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth, right? And I think there's real truth to that. Now, I guess the reason I bring that up is if you are seeing what Luke is talking about and you are placing your assets for 5 to 10 years down the road and you don't mind, and you have to be really honest with yourself here, you don't mind getting punched in the mouth really hard over the next couple of years, then sure, then you place your assets for the dollar getting weaker, because 5 or 10 years from now, it will be a lot weaker, I think. But I think it's very possible in the next, call it 2 years, the dollar just pummels everybody. And I don't know a lot of people who can withstand the pummeling. They say they can, but when they start getting hit, they want to get out. And so not only that, but I think there is a great, great number of incredible opportunities to play the move in the dollar over the next couple of years. And I just want people to know that even though Luke might be right in the long term, it's possible that he's wrong in the short term, and that it's possible that I'm right in the short term, right? And I want people to go in with eyes open and understand that the move before the dollar going to zero could very well be going back to all-time highs. And I would hate for them to get shook out of their long-term trades if they weren't prepared for that.
Brent, you said earlier that there's a possibility that foreign capital flows could drive equity markets much higher. Now, we talked about that in terms of how it is plausible for the mechanism to operate. In the current environment, where we're seeing what to me are a lot of recession signals and bearish stock signals, is that mechanism strong enough to overcome the bearish factors, or is it maybe a setup that we're going to see a bear market that I think is coming, that maybe still it's a short-lived cyclical bear market and there's still another wave higher? Or is it really that you think stocks are headed higher from here right now?
So, you know, last fall in Q4 and early and specifically very end of December, I was pretty aggressively buying equities. And that turned out we were fortunate that was the right call. And we had a very good first, call it 4 months of the year. And, you know, just as being prudent, you know, we kind of took down exposure a little bit and bought some puts in early May, which has really helped us out. I just think that the next 3 or 4 months are pretty uncertain. Let's just say it that way. And, you know, I think prudence says to just be careful for the next 2 or 3 months until we get some more visibility on what's actually going to happen. I think that the dollar breaking out is, I kind of think, going to be the key to the U.S. market, maybe moving higher, the U.S. equities moving higher, when that starts to cause problems abroad. I actually think the dollar is going to break out later in the fall, but it could be as soon as next month. There's a couple of things that I'm looking at that tells me that, you know, we're not going to have to wait another year to see what the dollar does. Because we were fortunate to have a good, you know, first part of the year, we kind of have the luxury of being a little careful over the next 3 or 4 months. And so we're going to be careful. And listen, I should always caveat this. My mind can change later today based on what I see. But as of right now, I think it's probably likely that equities kind of consolidate, maybe go up and down over the next 2 or 3 months. Perhaps we have a volatile summer while we're trying to figure out which way to go. But ultimately, just to be clear, I ultimately do think that we are going to see higher highs before we see significantly lower lows in equities.
I want to come to a very similar question, but let's go back to gold now. You and I think, both agree here as we're speaking Wednesday morning, we're flirting with that 1350 level. So far, it's been rejected pretty aggressively, but of course, anything is possible. Let's suppose, Brent, going back to your statement that your mind can change very quickly, let's suppose that by the time our listeners hear this interview, about 36 hours from now on Thursday evening, that we have seen a breakout in gold and we've got a daily close over 1400. At that point, is it time to just throw in the towel and say, oh, okay, we got the gold call wrong. It turns out that the move is on to the upside and it seems like dollar and gold are going to move up together and, you know, it's time to roll with it and increase your gold holdings? Or is that a signal that, okay, it's gotten ahead of itself and it's about to reverse maybe as the dollar comes off of a low?
So, you know, that's a very good question, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are kind of wondering this exact thing right now. I would be very, very, very careful chasing it at 1400 right now. If we're at 1400 by the end of the week, you know, that would be a pretty strong sign that we're looking at a breakout, right? But even if we have a breakout, I think we'll probably come back and test, you know, the 1360, 1375 area before then moving back above 1400 again and up to 1500 or whatever it is. I've seen too many times people buy these breakouts, quote unquote, only to see gold pull back, you know, $50, $60 in a very short period of time. You know, I think it's worth remembering. I would suggest that investors do this or listeners do this. Go back and look at a chart of gold last year versus this year, year to date. Now, they're not exact, but they are very similar. In 2018, we had a big run up in the spring. We had a pull back into May. Gold then popped back to like 1315 or 1320 right ahead of the Fed meeting in June. And by the end of June, we were at 1250. So, you know, it's not exactly like that this year, but it's pretty similar. I mean, you just don't know where we're going to go. This is part of the reason why for the last 6 or 7 years, I've been encouraging people to just buy some gold and forget about it. Now, I don't think it's going to pay off yet, but I think you should own it. Hopefully, people listening already have some gold in their portfolio. If you already have some gold in your portfolio, you don't have to chase it here. If it goes to 1400, be patient. When it pulls back to 1370 or something like that, then maybe start adding. But I wouldn't be buying. If I wake up tomorrow morning and gold's at 1400, I'm not going to be adding until at least the end of the month. I would wait and kind of see where we're at 2 or 3 weeks from now.
Brent, earlier in this interview, you mentioned that you're in the process of launching a special purpose fund to pursue the opportunities that you see relative to the dollar index. Now, just to explain to our listeners, because that fund is only available to accredited investors, Brent is not really at liberty to make any specific representations about it, the investment strategy and so forth. But what I do want to ask, Brent, is just what is the approximate timing, and for the accredited investors who are qualified to invest and learn more about that, how should they contact you in order to find out more about what you're up to?
Yeah, I think it's important to start off and say, listen, this isn't something for everybody. We designed this. I'm partnering with Keith Dicker of IceCap Asset Management to launch this vehicle. And we're doing it because we both have very similar businesses where we manage money for high net worth individuals. We see the dollar getting stronger as the biggest single factor influencing global markets over the next 2 or 3 years. And it has the potential to impact markets extremely negatively, especially for investors outside the United States. And so it's very difficult to protect against these types of moves and separately managed accounts for individuals. We wanted to have a vehicle through which we could put some of our clients' capital in there to help protect against the potentially negative effects of a stronger dollar, but then also capitalize on what we see as incredible opportunities as the dollar does get stronger. It's not for everybody, but we think it plays an extremely important part of an overall diversified portfolio. And if somebody wants to learn more about it, I'm available at brent@santiagocapital.com. Happy to discuss in more detail.
Well, Brent, it's great to finally get you on the show for a full-length feature interview. Look forward to having you back. And in the meantime, we're going to have you every few weeks on at Macro Voices All-Stars to get an update on some of these views. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to finally have Brent on for a full feature interview. We had so much fun with him out in the Macro Voices live event in Vancouver, and he certainly has been a contributor to your All Stars. So it was great to have him. You know, the one thing that I took away from that interview was when you and Brent started talking about food inflation and what's happening, obviously, out in the farms in the Midwest and the flooding. And it really made my hamster wheel turn, because when we had strategists like John Greenwood come on, a lot of their theories around inflation is very much linking it to money supply. And whenever there's these big surges in money supply, that inevitably leads to inflation, and it needs to be fought with higher interest rates. But when you have food inflation impacting the CPI, and you have basically farm goods and things like this rising in their price, and it's causing the CPI to rise, is the raising interest rates, or the interest rates rising to fight that, the solution? I mean, in my mind, these farmers are heavily indebted and on the verge of bankruptcy in many cases, and tightening up credit conditions and making it more expensive for them to access capital would only bankrupt more farmers. I would think the solution to actually lowering those inflationary pressures is by making the capital more available to them at much cheaper prices and providing subsidies or other things to those farmers. So I'm thinking that this type of inflation is this one that would lead to a monetary policy response if the primary input is food.
Well, Patrick, of course, the BLS excludes food and energy prices from core CPI. So, you know, in terms of what would drive a monetary policy decision, I don't think food prices drive it. But it's another indication of a systemic problem that we have, which is things that you absolutely must have to survive, like food. The price is going up, and it's not a matter of too much money recklessly chasing, you know, not enough goods and services. It's a matter of the food that we need to feed ourselves costing more and more. So I don't think that's a monetary policy issue. But in any case, the reaction that I had, the strongest reaction to Brent's interview, is it's really fascinating to me to hear someone who has an out of consensus view, as Brent has, about the stock market. Because, you know, frankly, as much as I've heard plenty of people just tell me that everything's rosy and nothing is wrong, and because the U.S. economy is wonderful, the stock market's going to go up, I just don't buy that. And I think bears like me really need to check ourselves with people like Brent, who are saying, wait a minute, what if everything is not rosy and it's not good, but things are worse in Europe to the point where people whose safety trade was historically into their own sovereign bonds don't want to buy sovereign bonds issued by a country that's part of a monetary union that might be falling apart and which are already negative yielding. And so the U.S. stock market becomes the safety trade because the appreciating dollar delivers so much carry. That's the kind of scenario that stock market bears need to think really carefully about and consider, okay, what are the things that could really foul up a view that is economically driven on fundamentals that yields a bearish view about the stock market. So I found that aspect of Brandt's interview most interesting.
So moving on, we have Adam Collins joining us from Movement Capital, and he's also the creator of the website freecotdata.com. And we wanted to bring him on to the show to talk about Commitment to Trader Report. So welcome, Adam.
Hey, everybody. Happy to be here.
All right. So, Adam, let's, for the benefit of our listeners that do not understand Commitment to Traders or what it is, why don't we take an opportunity just to explain to them what the Commitment to Trader reports are?
Yeah, for sure. So the COT report basically shows how different types of traders are positioned in the futures markets.
And there's different classifications, right? There's the speculators or small traders, and then there's the hedgers and the larger speculators. Is that correct?
Yeah, but before we get to the like the different trader categories, one thing to understand is there's like four different types of COT reports. The main one to sort of figure out in the front end is whether you're using what's called the legacy report, which has been out since like 1986, and then the newer disaggregated report. The main difference is that the legacy report has a fewer number of categories, so it's a little more opaque in like who the people actually are. And then the disaggregated report, it just splits it up into more granular categories. So first it's like figure out if you're looking at legacy or disaggregated. And then the second decision is whether you're looking at the COT report that just looks at futures positioning or looks at positioning on both futures and options on futures. So personally, I use the disaggregated report. It's got a bunch of different categories. And then the futures and options report to sort of have the most comprehensive view of positioning.
Okay. So now just for our listeners, I didn't mention it earlier, but Adam put together a great chart book for us so we can look at these different commitment to trader reports. So let's take a dive into it. Where do you want to start off in taking a look at this?
So we've sort of gotten the intro stuff out of the way. We can look at slide 6, where I sort of break down all these different trader categories that you mentioned. And it's important to note that the categories are different based on the contract type. So for example, if it's a commodity contract like corn, that has different positioning categories than a financial contract like the Swiss franc or something. So for example, in commodities, these are the main trader categories. We've got producers and merchants, who are sort of like the commercial producers and users of that commodity. We've got swap dealers who use futures to hedge price risk related to swaps. We've got money managers, which is the biggest speculative category, and that includes registered CTAs, CPOs, or other, you know, fund-like entities. Then we've got other reportables, who are basically, you know, not registered funds, but they are big traders trading above a contract's reporting limit. That sort of depends on the contract. And then the last category in commodities are non-reportable. So these are typically called small traders who are trading below the reporting limit. Now, to get into the different categories for financials, these are the main ones. We've got dealers, which are analogous to, you know, hedgers in commodity, but in financial contracts, dealers, think of them like sell side companies who use futures to sort of hedge the price risk they sort of carry when they sell products to end users. It's the same end goal, which is the reason why they're transacting in futures markets isn't to speculate, but more so to offset price risk. And then when we turn to the speculative categories in financials, we've got asset managers, leveraged funds, and other reportables. So that's sort of an overview of the different types of categories.
Adam, I use the Commitment of Traders reports myself, and like most government data, it's not exactly optimally organized. What is wrong with the way that the government organizes it, and what opportunity is there to improve on it?
Yeah, so I think that the COT report in its raw form, you know, it's released weekly and it just shows like spot net positioning. You definitely got to give it some context. So one of the first things I do is rather than just look at, you know, net positioning, like let's say hedge funds are net long 20,000 contracts or, you know, commercials are net short something, it's important to take that net figure and divide it by contracts open interest, because the truth of it is a lot of these contracts have like significantly fluctuating open interest figures. So they get sort of ebb and flow in their popularity. One of the biggest examples of this over the past few years has been VIX futures. So VIX futures, you know, 10 years ago, relatively small market, low open interest. Now, much more frequently traded, right? And so if you're just looking at net positioning, the current net positioning will look, you know, drastically more extreme than it actually is if you don't take that net number and divide it by, you know, the size of the market. And so that's where the first thing I like to do is to scale the data by open interest. And the second thing I like to do to make COT actionable is you've got to normalize net positioning across contracts. So for example, let's say somebody comes to you and says, all right, you know, traders are net long 40% of the interest in platinum. You don't know if that's historically extreme or not, right? There's no sort of historical context for it. And people solve this two ways. Some people create percentiles. Some people create, you know, a Z-index. I personally use a percentile. I think they're both valid. And the whole point of this is to sort of transform that current reading and to show you whether it's high or low relative to the past few years. So, for example, if you make a five-year percentile, it will read 100% if, you know, a trader category has its highest positioning over the past 5 years. And the main benefit of normalizing the data across contracts is it allows you to like at a glance know if a trader category is super long or super short, just because everything is sort of rebased to between, you know, 100 and zero with a percentile. So in summary, it's important to scale the data based on open interest and then also normalize the data so you can sort of compare it across contracts.
So, Adam, going into that, obviously there's some traders that just love to trade around these COT reports, but you think there's some pitfalls in this. What's the major pitfalls of reading too much into these positions?
Yeah, 100%. So for people looking at the chart book, this starts with slide 14. And I think the biggest pitfall is just reading too much into the data. The truth about positioning is that more often than not, it's not extreme. And so therefore, you shouldn't sort of pay attention to positioning if we're, you know, right in the middle of where traders have been positioned over the past 5 years. So there's no signal there. It's a bunch of noise. So to me, you know, first pitfall is at any given time, there's likely only a handful of contracts where you can truly call it extreme positioning. The second pitfall on slide 15 is sort of this knee-jerk reaction to wanting to fade extreme spec positioning. And I understand why people want to do this because, you know, let's say you see a chart going around, you say, oh, you know, speculators are all on one side of the trade and everybody wants to be the contrarian to fade it, right? But the truth of it is you have to sort of gut check it against priced action. So let's say we've got a contract of where, you know, speculators are all long. Let's say the percentile is maxed out. They're carrying a very big long position. But if it's a scenario where price action is only helping them, and let's say, you know, everybody's long and price continues to rip higher, they don't have an incentive to liquidate that position, right? They haven't been put under pressure. So to me, it's not enough to have extreme positioning. That can sort of exist by itself, but it does get more actionable when you sort of combine extreme positioning with price action that is hurting the majority. Think of it like, you know, the common analogy for crowded trades is like people yelling fire in a crowded theater. Somebody yelling fire is equivalent to price action going the opposite way of how everybody is positioned. So I think that's sort of a pitfall, is just analyzing positioning in isolation and not asking yourself, okay, is price action helping them or is it hurting them? And if it's hurting them, that's where positioning can actually lead to a move. And then let's see, on slide 16, another pitfall, I sort of call it market relevance, but all it means is this, is that this COT report, it's looking at all these different asset classes, right? We're looking at stocks, bonds, FX, commodities. And the reality is that commodities are really only, they're the only asset class where futures is the primary market. So when it comes to all the other financial contracts, futures are, that's not the main destination, right? If you're looking at a COT report on a foreign currency pair, you're completely ignoring, you know, the spot FX market. And to me, while futures positioning is typically representative of like, you know, broad market positioning, you just have to take it with a grain of salt because you're just observing a small slice of the overall market.
Adam, you've done some fantastic work on your website addressing, obviously we can't address the pitfalls that have to do with traders' human behavior, but the part about the government not really presenting the data with the context that's needed to interpret, you've really worked some wonders on it. Tell us a little bit about what you've done and maybe show us some examples of how those data are presented from some screenshots from your website.
Yeah, for sure. So the whole point of the website is to give context. And rather than focusing on like a snapshot of current positioning, to sort of show you with graphs of whether that current positioning is truly extreme or not. So the main indicator on the website, it's got all these different contracts, but what I basically show a lot of is that five-year percentile metric, which is sort of normalizing across all these different contracts whether current positioning right now is actually historically extreme or not. And so that's what you're mainly going to find on the website are graphs of five-year percentiles. So you can see like at a glance, you know, where extreme positioning is. But in the chart book, I've sort of pulled out some contracts where position actually truly is extreme right now. So for people turning to it on slide 17, one that stands out is definitely silver. And so in this chart, remember, I'm showing not just, you know, speculators, but also producers and users too. But you can see that traders haven't been, they haven't been this bearish on silver in a very long time. And in fact, on slide 18, I don't just show the five-year percentile. I sort of convert positioning into a dollar figure. And so right now, traders are net short silver futures, which is a really, really rare thing. In fact, it happened in like, you know, summer 2018, but outside of summer 2018, it's basically never happened in silver futures over the past decade or so. And so one thing that stands out is you could definitely label trader sentiment in silver as bearish because they're definitely, you know, positioned that way. Another one that stands out, or two others, you know, very quickly are cotton and sugar. Similar story. These are both very crowded net short trades. And cotton and sugar, and honestly, a lot of soft commodities have fallen in that basket over the past few months. And that's why I think it's super important to not just see something like, oh, you know, all these traders are short sugar and cotton and want to go out and go long. You have to sort of contrast it with, okay, are these commodities in steady downtrends or are we at an inflection point of where they're sort of ripping and everybody's still on the wrong side? Another current graph would be on slide 21, another commodity. It's WTI crude oil. And we can see how there's definitely a very tight relationship between price action and position. We've seen it in WTI over the past few weeks. So, you know, as we've corrected lower, speculators have pulled long exposure. And this graph, it's also another dollar-based graph. So you can see how back late 2017, early 2018, that's when sort of spec positioning got at its most net long. It sort of eclipsed, you know, net long $50 billion in futures and options. And now we're definitely a lot lower. Collectively, they're net long around like $27 billion. And some other contracts we can quickly run through. So I've sort of talked about commodities, and with the COT report, I definitely think you should lean toward giving it more importance in commodities because that's the primary market futures are. But we can touch on some financial stuff. So first off, in slide 22, we've got the Swiss franc. So basically, there's two currencies that are crowded net shorts against the USD. First one is the Swiss franc. The second one is New Zealand dollar. Similar story in both. Traders are just very, very short those two currencies against the USD. And then on slide 24, I turn to positioning and stocks. And so this chart, it's sort of an aggregation of multiple contracts. So we're looking at how traders are positioned in both the E-mini S&P, the E-mini NASDAQ, and then the mini Dow contract. And this is sort of a nuts chart. Patrick and I, we talked about this on Market Huddle a couple weeks ago, but you can sort of see how trader sentiment has changed and has drastically changed when it comes to equity futures over the past 3 years. So at the start of 2016, traders were extremely pessimistic. In fact, they actually got net short equity futures, which is something they did not do in 2008. So, you know, as the market turned in Feb 2016, they were very slow to sort of like, you know, pile on back to the long side as the market went higher. But then once they did it very quickly. And basically it peaked at, it was in late January 2018 when the net spec position eclipsed. It was like net long 120 billion, which was an all-time high. That was at that point in time, traders had never been that net long more U.S. equity futures. But they definitely got spooked after both February and Q4 last year. And although, you know, I know we're roughly 5-6% from all-time highs, trader position has come back a lot. The net spec position has come back from, you know, 120, 130 billion to being about net long 50 billion now. And so that's sort of a snapshot of how traders are positioned in equity futures. And the last graph I've got, it's on slide 25 for people looking on the chart book. This is sort of my dashboard graph. So this is looking at a summary of all these different commodity contracts and specifically spec positioning in these contracts, right? And so you can see on the left-hand side, this is stuff where people are really bullish. On the right-hand side, these are contracts where traders are leaning more so bearish. And what stands out is there aren't really any contracts that are crowded longs from the spec side, but like we talked about earlier, silver, cotton, and sugar definitely stand out as the as three of the most crowded shorts.
Well, Adam, thanks again for sharing this excellent presentation with us. And listeners, again, Adam's website is freecotdata.com. freecotdata.com, and really reorganize this commitment of traders information in a much more meaningful way. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time for this week. I just want to remind our listeners, we sure would appreciate your help with a review on iTunes, because as we're looking for sponsorship, that's exactly what they're looking for, is who's given us those five-star reviews on iTunes. So if you can help us out, we'd tremendously appreciate it. And be sure to register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit is you'll receive our research roundup email. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
All right, this week they're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book prepared by Adam here that we discussed in the post game. There's also an article titled, "The Fed Has No Choice But to Return to Ultra-Low Interest Rates," as well as Harley Bassman, Convexity Maven piece that is titled, "Can You Hear Me Knocking?" So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.